Hello, welcome to another podcast. This is Dr. Leo Stauder from Dania Beach, Florida. This is Biology on the Beach, and we're going to be talking today about cells. As I have my feet in the sand, sort of poking my toes in the sand, I see people walking by. What I'm seeing walking by are individuals that are composites of cells. Their basic fundamental unit of life is the cell. We put a bunch of cells together and we get this individual who's walking before me, and, well, shall we say, maybe a Speedo he should not be wearing. But cells are going to be, as you remember, the fundamental units of life. And Robert Koch saw Koch under a microscope, and he made very, very minute cuts of cork and put them into like a semi-slide, put them under the microscope, and he noticed that these represented like little rooms. And indeed, that's what he was looking at. He was looking at the cellulose, or the stuff that we call fiber when we eat our foods. And that cellulose, or that fiber, makes like a little room, makes like a little square. And it has the walls, and basically those walls were the cell when the plant was living. But now that the plant has died and it's cork, now it has just these remnants of these walls that look like little rooms. Well, in those days, a room wasn't called a room, it was called a cell. We even have that today if we think of a monastery. We think of a monastery having cells. You know, you go and sleep in your cell. And we also have that in our incarceration system still. The place where people hang out, you know, if they're incarcerated, is in their rooms or their cells. So that's where we get the word cell from, is Robert Koch. Now, Van Leeuwenhoek, is another nice name, observed bacteria and also sperm called animalcules. So he called these guys sort of like animals that were really, really small. Of course, we distinguish now between bacteria and sperm, but in those days they really didn't. But they did see that there's this whole microscopic world that's out there. And of course, a bacteria could be a single cell organism, and so could a sperm. So is a sperm. So Robert Brown, discovered the nucleus. And the nucleus is going to be the center of the cell. So that's sort of a little bit of the history. Now notice that the word nucleus, even though we use it in chemistry in our talk on chemistry, we said that's the center of the element. In this case, the nucleus is the center of the cell. And it's distinct from the nucleus of an element or of an atom. So the cell theory, as we already said before, was that, you know, cells are going to be the basic fundamental unit of life. The cell is the smallest unit of life. But also, every organism is composed of cells. Just as I said, that guy with the bad Speedo going by, he's composed of cells. Life comes only from cells. So these are the three parts of the cell theory. That every organism is composed of cells. The cell is the smallest unit of life. And also that life comes only from cells. Now, these may seem obvious, but there was a time when people and scientists even believed in spontaneous generation. This, in a nutshell, is a theory that life does not come from cells, that life can come from dead tissue, so not living cells. So this spontaneous generation theory really was saying that life comes from non-living matter. And even though it's an ancient untruth theory, it really was not all that ancient. You could even look at maybe even the 19th century where it was still believed. So according to this bogus theory, life comes from the ether. And the ether was considered what we call today the air. So the air that is around us, that was called the ether. And the ether had life in it, which our air does as well. There's bacteria in our ether, in our air. There is also many of the atoms that we need to sustain life. And, you know, we have oxygen here, and carbon dioxide, and carbon monoxide, and nitrogen, all sorts of different things in our air. But the idea was is that the ether actually had a germinative effect. It could germinate life. All it had to do was to have something be exposed to the ether, and that magically would create life. So the argument for spontaneous generation was the everyday process of seeing what happens in life. So if you take meat and you have it rot, I put it out in the Florida sun, for instance, and soon there will be maggots that will grow out of that dead meat. So it looks as though that dead meat has spawned living things, and that's what it looks like. But the argument against spontaneous generation was brought by Pasteur. And Louis Pasteur came out with a flask. And because the spontaneous generation theory is sort of predicated on this idea of this ether, Pasteur said, okay, what I'll do is I'll make a flask. And the flask will have the nutritive brew of, let's say, beef soup. I'll boil it so it will make sure that it is sterile. And then I'll connect it to a top on my flask that will sort of have like a curve to it, like a swan neck to it. And we'll wait a while and see what happens. Well, what happened was that nothing happened. That this beef soup that could still spawn, you know, some kind of growth, spawned nothing. So you might ask, why? Why would that be? Why did this happen? Well, Pasteur said, well, you know, it still is exposed to the ether, and if the ether is where, you know, life comes from, then, you know, your theory is incorrect. Well, the naysayers that still believed in spontaneous generation said, no, your soup would not be able to spawn life anyways. So it's bogus. So Pasteur said, okay, what I'll do is I'll break the stem of my flask, and you'll see that bacteria and maggots will grow inside of the beef soup. You'll see it. So he did that, and indeed that's what happened. So the idea of just being exposed to the ether was disproved by Pasteur, and in that wake, also the idea of spontaneous generation was also disproved by him as well. He had a very deep understanding of bacteria, and so he really knew that this was really a bogus kind of theory. Also, he realized that a fly is so named because he doesn't like to walk. So if you think of the long gooseneck, for a fly to get in there to put his eggs into the soup so that maggots will grow, you would have to have that fly sort of like in a circuitous route, and it would be very difficult for him to get into the soup. He would have to walk part of it. And as we say, flies like to fly, and they really don't want to walk. So that's how Pasteur sort of disproved the spontaneous generation theory, and then this ushered in then the idea that cells only arise by division of a previously existing cell. So life comes only from life. We have that famous book by Mary Shelley, Frankenstein, which sort of like was in the vein of the spontaneous generation. So when we look at the cell structure, let's just look at it, just a general cell structure. We see that on the outside of the cell is going to be a membrane. The membrane, as you remember, is just going to be just something that's going to just allow things in and things out, whatever those things are. So a membrane really is like an envelope. Think of that, an envelope like on a letter. It's the outside covering. When we get a letter, we usually don't just read the envelope. The envelope just contains the good stuff on the inside, which would be the letter. I guess that analogy is, well, I won't be able to use that for very many years since people don't really write letters anymore. But we have that as an envelope. So it's going to be the plasma membrane, which is going to cover the cell. Inside of the plasma membrane are structures. They're called organelles. literally small organs. So when we look at a nucleus, which is the center part of the cell, we see it's going to be an organelle. Also, there's other organelles that help the function of the cell. We don't need to go into those right now, but we will later. So the organelles are going to be small organs that are going to allow the cell to function. Now, these organelles float inside of a fluid, and the fluid is called cytoplasm. The word cyto means cell. So anytime you see cyto, you know it means cell. So cytoplasm means literally the substance of a cell. Now, if you have a plasma screen at home on your computer, or maybe you have a big screen plasma TV, you know that if you touch the screen, it will sort of deform a bit, because it's like a plasma kind of substance, sort of like a liquidy kind of substance. So when we look at the general structure of the cell, we see the plasma membrane is going to surround the cell. The small parts of the inside of the cell are called organelles, which mean what? Good, little organs. There's two major kinds of cells. We have a prokaryotic cell and a eukaryotic cell. Easy to remember, because you are a eukaryotic cell. Now, karyot means nut in Greek. So if you have a nucleus, it looks like that there's a nut that's there. So if you were to consider, like, for instance, a walnut, you have your shell, the walnut, called the plasma membrane. Open that walnut up, and inside is the walnut. Now, walnut would be considered the nut, or the karyon. So the karyotic cell that is prokaryotic is going to be before. Pro means before. So you're not going to have a nucleus in these cells that are called prokaryotic. A good example would be bacteria. Now, bacteria has no membranes around its nucleus. Around its organelles. It's just like cell soup. So because there is no nucleus around the... there's no membrane around the nucleus, we cannot really see it, even though it's there. So we call these prokaryotic cells. You, as we already said, you are a eukaryotic cell. And animals, meaning us, and also plants, are both eukaryotic cells. That means that they have a membrane around their nucleus. Because you... EU means true, and karyon, of course, means nut. So there's a true nut in there. You can see that nucleus. And so that's the two different kinds of prokaryotic cells, of cells. So if I were to ask what the example of a prokaryotic cell is, you would say bacteria, good. If I were to say what are the examples of a eukaryotic cell, you would say animals and plants, very good. What's the difference between a plant and an animal? Plants have a cell wall. So we just talked about Hoch and how he discovered that the idea of the cell. And he saw the rooms, and these rooms were the cellulose, remember, of the cork. So that those walls are called the cell walls, and only plants have them. Plants also have a plasma membrane, so it's almost as if a plant has one additional thing, and that is the cell wall. Animals have a cell plasma membrane, but they don't have a cell wall. But if you picture an animal cell inside of a plant, so there's still a plasma membrane, but the plant's going to be limited as far as how big it can get, because it's going to be prohibited from the cell wall. Because the cell wall is going to prevent it from, you know, going anywhere. So given this, then, plant cells are going to be square. So a plant tends to be angular. Think of a branch or whatever. It's going to be an angularness to it. Excuse me. So there's going to be that angularness. I mean, if you look at a palm tree, it just goes straight up kind of thing. But if you look at us, animals, we see that there's a roundness to us. You know, we have, look at your fingers, you know, you got these round fingers. You know, look at your body, it's sort of roundish. Look at your face, it's roundish. That's because the cells that make up us is going to be, of course, round, whereas the cells that make up plants are going to be more angular and squarer. Plants cannot burst, so their cells cannot burst. We, you know, you never see a person blowing up, but our cells can burst because we don't have a wall around our membrane. So plant cells cannot burst. And that process is called lysis. And we sort of talked about lysis before when we talked about hydrolysis. Remember? We said lysis is to break apart, right? And in hydrolysis, we use water to break apart the individual components of a macromolecule, if you remember. So this kind of lysis too can occur in animal cells. If they get too big, too filled with water, they can blow up or lyse. But plant cells can't do that. Plant cells can, however, shrink. So if a plant doesn't get enough water, then his individual plasma membrane is not pushing against the wall of his cell. And if that individual plasma membrane is not pushing against the cell wall of the plant, then the plant will start to droop. That's why we see drooping plants. If we add water to them, then their plasma membrane pushes against the cell wall, and then they stand up straight again. So animal cells, as we said, are round. That's why we are round. Animal cells do not have a cell wall, so therefore they could burst. They can also shrink, but so can plant cells. But it's the bursting thing that's really distinct. When we look at a plant cell as well, we see it has a cell wall, which makes it distinct from an animal. Also, remember that plants can make their own food, whereas we as animals cannot. So if we look at the plant cell diagram, we'll see that it has chloroplasts. Now, chloroplast is going to be the major area of food production for the cell. As you know, we have a potato, for instance, and the potato has starch in it, carbohydrate, which is good for us. So those carbohydrates were produced by the potato plant, and they were produced by the chloroplasts within the plant cell itself. So that's two distinctions. One, so the plant cell has a cell wall, an animal does not. A plant cell has a chloroplast, the animal does not. And the third thing that makes it distinct is that a plant cell has a vacuole. So plant cells have a water storage system. Animal cells do not have vacuoles. So those are the three basic components of a plant, which distinguishes it from the animal. So the plant has a cell wall, also has a what? Right, chloroplasts, and it also has vacuoles. Animal cells do not have those. But other than that, the plant and the animal cell is very, very similar in its components. Now, if we compare bacteria, plants, and animal cells, we know that a bacteria is classified as a what kind of cell? Right, a prokaryotic cell. Why do we call it prokaryotic? Because it doesn't have a nucleus, right? Very good. So we think of the animal and the plant cell as being a what kind of cell? A eukaryotic. Very good. Eukaryotic cells have a nucleus that we can see. So those are the major things that we see. And also a bacteria will have a cell wall usually, but not always. Now, the plasma membrane. We talked about that envelope that wraps around the cell. The plasma membrane is a bilipid layer. Bi means two, and lipid means fat. So therefore, it's a two layers of fat. Sounds really yummy, doesn't it? It contains a phospholipid. And also, it's a fluid mosaic. Now, what's a mosaic? If we were to look at a painting that's a mosaic, if you get really, really close, all you see is just dots of whatever, paint or whatever, or shells or whatever the artist used. But as we step back from that mosaic, we see that it actually makes sort of like a picture. So that's how the cell looks. It's composed of different individual component parts, but if we step back, we see that it indeed is a layer or a membrane that's going to wrap around the cell. Now the heads of the plasma membrane face outside and on the inside of the cell. So there's going to be heads that are going to be facing, they're going to be found on the outside of the plasma membrane, and then you're going to have the head also being found inside of the plasma membrane. But it has tails. It has two tails. These two tails face each other. So if you picture a man without arms, and he's got his head, he's got his feet, and his legs. Picture two guys laying down with their feet touching each other. That's how the plasma membrane looks. Their feet sort of connect to each other, where their heads are facing out. One head's facing out into the outside of the cell, the other one's facing directly on the inside of the cell. So the heads are going to have a quality, and it's called hydrophilic. And we talked about hydrophilic before. We said it was water-loving. Okay, the phosphate makes the head polar. So you know what the idea of polar is. Remember, it's a positive or negative force. And water loves polar because water is polar. So it likes itself, essentially, right? Birds of a feather kind of thing. Now, the tails are called hydrophobic. Hydro means water. Phobic means fearing. So hydrophobic is going to repel water because they really are what? What are the tails really composed of? They're composed of fat. Because they're fat, fat and water don't what? They don't mix. So fat is going to be nonpolar, so it's not going to be dissolving, or it's not going to be a hydrophilic component. It's going to be hydrophobic instead. So that's the quality of the plasma membrane. You have these heads on the outside and also on the inside layer. And in between those two layers are these legs that are facing at each other. So if we think of the dynamics of the plasma membrane, water is going to be attracted to the heads, but once water gets inside to the legs or the tails, they're going to be repelled. So that water will go through the plasma membrane. It won't stay inside of the plasma membrane because oil and water don't mix, or fat and water don't mix. So as we said, it's like a fluid mosaic, this plasma membrane. Well, embedded in part of it is going to be cholesterol. Even though cholesterol gets a bad rap, it nonetheless is going to be a component part of the plasma membrane, very important component part. While the plasma membrane is basically fat, there's some protein in it as well. So it indeed is a mosaic. So we have different kinds of protein. We have a surface protein. We also have what we call a transmembrane protein. Trans means it goes between. So it's going to be a protein that goes from one end of the plasma membrane to the other. So it's going to go right through the plasma membrane from one head to the other head. Now the surface protein is just going to be on the top of a layer. So when we attach a surface protein to a carbohydrate, we get a receptor. And receptors give the cell its identity. They serve as markers for the cell. And they bind certain hormones to the cell. So it's as if the receptors are like our faces. Our faces are, you know, if we take a picture of us and show it to anybody, they say, oh, yeah, I know that person because I know what their face looks like. That's our identity. The cell's identity are the receptors. So each cell has a receptor. So let's use an example, like the human egg. The human egg has receptors on it. And these receptors are going to be receiving only one cell, and that's going to be the sperm. So it could float down the fallopian tube, and it does. As it floats down the fallopian tube, there are other cells there with their receptors too, but they don't bother the egg because those receptors are different. Only one cell will actually be able to stimulate the egg, and that's going to be the sperm. So if there's no sperm available, the egg just, you know, gets expelled. But if there is a sperm available, that sperm will be attracted by the receptors. And once the sperm enters the egg, then the receptors go away. And when they go away, then the other sperm can't find the egg, even though they're right in the midst of it. Because that's the way it works. So it's as if, you know, the sperm are like looking around, and I know it was here somewhere. Where was it? But then as soon as the receptors leave, they go, oh, where'd it go? I don't know. I thought it was here. And that's just the way that works. It's also beneficial to us, these receptors, because we can also use them in certain cells so that hormones will know where to go. Now, a hormone is going to be a protein, as we talked about. And hormones float in our bodies. Insulin is a hormone. Also, there's another hormone called thyroxine. Thyroxine comes from the pituitary gland, which is right in the middle of our brain. And it pushes its components, the pituitary, pushes its components into the blood system. There's no direct connection between the pituitary gland and the thyroid gland. There's no direct way, there's no conveyor belt that can bring it right from the pituitary to the thyroid. All we have is the blood system. So the pituitary dumps the hormone into the blood system, and the blood system takes it all the way around the whole body. And eventually it will take it to the thyroid, because it takes it everywhere. So the question is, why doesn't thyroxine stimulate, for instance, the pancreas, or stimulate the spleen, or stimulate your little toe? Because they're all made of cells, right? Well, the answer is that no other cell but the thyroid has the receptors for thyroxine. So that way, we have a specific way of stimulating the thyroid. And we have a specific way of really having, as we said, an identity for each cell. Now, what's the story with these transmembrane proteins? Well, we already talked about water can go in and out of the cell easily. But there are some substances that cannot get into the cell because they're too big. So how are we going to get them in instead? Well, this would be analogous to, think of a store. Let's say Macy's. If we have the Macy's doors closed, people can't get in. But you would agree that air can probably get in through the bricks. So that would be like wood, or that would be like water going through the plasma membrane, no problem. There's really no way you're going to prohibit water from coming in or out of the cell. You're not really going to prevent air from going in or out between the bricks of Macy's. But to get people in, you need to open the doors. Those doors, the analogy would be these transmembrane proteins. They're going to allow for bigger substances, if you will, people, to get into the store or to go out as well. So the transmembrane proteins would bring nutrients in to the cell, and they would also allow waste to exit the cell. So transmembrane proteins are transport proteins. They go from the outside to the inside, and they make good channels for large molecules to pass in and out of the cell. As we talked about, insulin was a hormone that helps with blood sugar levels. Well, what insulin does is it allows for glucose, which is sugar, to get into the cell. So it is a transmembrane protein. So it's going to be that kind of protein is going to assist in pushing the glucose inside of the cell because glucose is so big. So those unfortunate individuals that have diabetes have no insulin, so therefore glucose can't get into their cells. So that's why they need to inject insulin so that it will allow glucose to get into their cells. So let's talk about the cell size. Now, you would think that a cell could be as big as it wants to be, but it can't. It can only get so big. The reason is because the outside plasma membrane can only handle so much transport, things going in and out. If the inside of the cell gets too big, the outside, the plasma membrane, will not be able to support the inside. So you won't be able to get enough nutrients inside. You won't be able to get enough waste outside. It just doesn't work. So the outside of the cell must always be larger than the inside surface. This is called the cell surface to volume ratio. There's a finite time when the outside, I mean, there's, yeah, when the outside will just have to be as big, and that's it. It can't get any bigger. So normally, the outside of the cell is larger than the inside, and this allows for transport of stuff. If the cell ratio is off, if the inside is more, has more volume than the outside surface area, then the cell will not function properly. So it's prohibited from getting too big. So then the next question might be, well, how is it then that right now, like for instance on the beach here, I can see there's a little child, there's an infant, and it's being carried by her mother, which is much bigger. If they have the same cells, cell size, why is the infant smaller than the mother? Well, the answer, of course, is that the infant hasn't grown all its cells yet. It's the same as if a mouse cell is the same size as an elephant cell, then you would think that one would be the same size as the other. But when we look at the size of the cell, we see that we have the mouse equaling the elephant. So the mouse equals the elephant. This is an original drawing. If you're looking at the PowerPoint, there, that's an original drawing that I created there. I know it's hard to believe, but it's really original to me. So we have a mouse equaling the elephant. What do we mean by that? The mouse cell size equals the elephant size. They're exactly the same size. Well, not exactly the same, but close to the same size. But what makes the elephant bigger, of course, is that he has more cells. Just like with the infant or the mom has more cells. And the infant will catch up. Now, how big are cells? To get a general idea of the size of a cell, just look at a book and look at the end of the book, or the end of a sentence, and that would be the period. A period is going to be the size of one of our biggest human cells. Not the biggest, but one of the biggest. And that's called the human egg. So the human egg is one of the biggest cells we have in our bodies. It's approximately 100 microns. And what's a micron? A micron is going to be a relatively small unit of measure. So if we look at a period, that's going to be 100. But picture now 14 little periods inside that one period. That would be the size of a red blood cell, which is one of the smallest of our cells. So our red blood cells are very, very small. You can get an idea of that by just looking at the end of a sentence, a period, and then seeing 14 little periods inside. So that gives you an idea of the cell size itself. Now, since we're talking about biology, and I said that we're going to be concentrating more on human biology, we're still going to be looking at eukaryotic cells. And eukaryotic cells, as we remember, are both who and who? Animals and plants. Very good. Eukaryotic cell structure is that it has a cytoskeleton, which is a network of proteins. And we said that proteins are going to give us structure. We said that all of us is composed of protein. That's what gives us our structure. They're going to be called microfilaments and microtubules. Micro for small. Filament for being an actual, wire. And microtubule would be a small tube. So it's either a wire filled in or it'd be a tube which you have, you know, on the outside, and then it's basically just a long tube. These are called microfilaments and microtubules, or cytoskeleton. That builds a scaffolding. Now, a scaffolding is sort of like a structural unit that a person would put outside a building if they were going to paint the outside of a building. They can go up and down, they're scaffolding. So it's the same thing inside of the cell. It would be giving its structure to the cell. So, for instance, if you close your eye and look down and push at the top of your eyeball, you'll feel that your eyeball has like a little bit of water in it, so you can sort of push it in and out. But notice that you let go and it doesn't lose its shape. It's because the cells of your eye have cytoskeleton in it. All cells have a cytoskeleton in it, which gives the cell its shape. Now, the cytoskeleton is going to be the shape of the cell, but it also is going to be an anchor for the substances of the cell. And that anchor is going to be it's going to be anchoring all the organelles. So the organelles are sort of embedded inside of the cytoskeleton. Some specialized cytoskeleton, or at least a portion of it, being the microtubules, would be a flagella or a cilia. A flagella is a long tail, which is only going to be on a sperm. A cilia is found in a host of areas in the body. One of the most notable areas would be your respiratory tract or your lungs. These little cilia are on the outside of the cells, and they're sort of like hair-like projections, which help to push like any kind of dust or anything that we would have in our lungs. It'll push it so that we can just expel it. So those are microtubules that move. It's flagella and also cilia. Then the other structures of the eukaryotic cell will have the nucleus, which is the control center of the cell. Inside a nucleus, we have the DNA we talked about, which is going to be DNA wound around and sort of like made into a dense structure that looks sort of like a human without a head. That's called a chromosome. Chromo means color, and some means body. So it's a colored body. If you've ever seen a picture of chromosomes laid out, you'll see that they are indeed different colors. So hereditary information is found in the nucleus. Also ER is there as well. We have two forms of ER, and ER is called endoplasmic reticulum. Now we talked about plasmic, so we get an idea it's sort of like has a fluid to it. But endo means inside, and that's easy to remember because it's in, inside. And reticulum means a net. So it literally is an inside net. It comes in two varieties. Then we have a rough form and a smooth form. The rough ER has bumps of RNA. These are called ribosomes. And the function of the rough ER is to make protein. Smooth ER has no bumps, so it has no ribosomes. But its function is to create fat. So easy to remember. If you take a steak, let's say a T-bone steak, and rub it against your nose, what would you feel with that bone in there? You'd feel rough, wouldn't you? So remember, rough ER produces protein, like a steak. Now take the outer covering of the steak, that fat part, and rub it against your nose, and what do you feel? You feel smooth, right? So that's an easy way to remember. Smooth ER gives you fat. Rough ER gives you what? Protein. Very good. Now the Golgi complex is going to be a bunch of pita breads put on top of each other. And this is for packaging. So it's going to package any products that are created in the ER. And what would be the products of the ER but protein and fat. Very good. Now lysosomes, look at that word again, lice. So lysosomes are going to be bodies. Remember, some is a body. They're going to be bodies that are going to break stuff up. So they're the garbage collectors of the cell. We also have mitochondria. Now, a mitochondria is going to be the power plant of the cell. We think of the mighty mitochondria because it produces ATP, which is going to be the energy for the cell. So think of mighty mitochondria. They also look strikingly like little pieces of carrot. So think of carrots, orange carrots, giving you energy. Also, our eukaryotic cell of our plant will have chloroplasts. And these are going to be the site of photosynthesis. Photo means light. Synthesis means put together. So it's light putting together stuff. What is put together? Puts together the food for the plant. As we said, the potato has starch in it. And that starch is the plant food that we can also make our own food. The nucleolus is found inside of the nucleus. This makes the RNA that is going to be found in the rough ER. Chromosomes, as we said, are going to be found in the nucleus. This is hereditary information. And a centriole is going to be responsible for cell division. So they don't do anything. They just hang out by the nucleus, and they're basically just there until cell division occurs. That's called mitosis. We'll talk about mitosis later, but for now, just know that the centriole has a part to play in cell division. So in a word, it's best to memorize these structures with just one word. So we look at cytoskeleton as giving the cell its shape, Flagella is a whip. Cilia is a hair, those hairs. Ruffiar produces what? Protein. Smoothiar, fat. The nucleus is the brain of the cell. Chromosomes, DNA. Golgi, packaging. Lysosomes, garbage. Mitochondria, energy. And the nucleolus is going to be where the ribosomes come from, where the RNA comes from. So let's go through it. What is shape? Cytoskeleton. What is a whip? Flagella. What is Golgi? Packaging. What is a brain? Nucleus. Where is DNA? Chromosomes. What gives a cell its energy? Mitochondria. Nucleolus, ribosomes, RNA, very good. Protein, Ruffiar, Smoothiar, fat. So I get a general idea. Memorize the word with the structure. Now let's talk about a law of nature. In fact, let's talk about a law of nature next time. This is Dr. Leo Stauder saying thanks for listening and I hope that helped. This is Biology on the Beach, and we'll talk to you again. Bye now.